Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Wrath of the Oceans podcast. Two friends who discuss horror, fantasy, and science fiction books and topics. This is episode 14, an interview with J.S. Dewis and her book, The Last Watch. I'm Ron in Seattle, and as always, it's Jake in Boston.
Hey, how are you doing, Ron?
Good, good. Hey, today we're going to have J.S. Dewis on the show. And why don't we just get to the interview? We're so lucky to have our guest on the show today. She has a background in cinematography and video editing with a degree in film production from Columbia College in Chicago. She has written several scripts for award-winning feature films and shorts, which have been screened at festivals and conventions all across the United States. Her hobbies are all things visual: video games, drawing, photography, and graphic design. Her debut science fiction novel, The Last Watch, which is being described as the Expanse meets the Game of Thrones, will be available very soon on April 20th. Please welcome to the Wrath of the Iotians podcast, J.S. Dewis. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Both Jake and I read The Last Watch, and we thought it was just a terrific book. We are fans now. And hey, for our listeners, can you provide an overview of the book?
Sure thing, yeah. How I normally pitch it to people is I say the Night's Watch from a Game of Thrones in space, and that usually pretty much hooks people. And it's pretty accurate to that, but you know, it's a little more than that. So The Last Watch follows Commander Attaquin Rake, who commands a ship-turned watchtower that sits at the edge of the universe, and they're keeping watch for threats and things that may come from that side of the universe. And, you know, it's about the universe collapsing ultimately, which kind of spoiler, but not really spoiler.
Yeah, it was a terrific read. I did read somewhere that The Last Watch was inspired by a Jimmy Webb song. I'm actually a big fan of Jimmy Webb songwriting, and Jake is too. So we're very happy to hear about that. Can you tell us the story of the song that inspired you to write The Last Watch?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm a big Johnny Cash fan. I don't actually typically listen to a lot of country music specifically, but I'm big Johnny Cash. So when I encountered The Highwayman, which is the name of the song that the lyric is in, and I heard that line, I was like, oh my gosh.
Like, yes, yes.
There's so much here. The line is, I fly a starship across the universe divide, which is where the divide, which is the series name for The Last Watch, comes from, and why I named the phenomenon in it the divide is from that lyric. So I just kind of ran with it from there. You know, I got this image in my head of this, you know, starship commander flying towards the edge of the universe. And there's so many questions. What lies beyond? What might they find? Why are they going there? Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, are they forced to? Are they just adventurers? There was just a lot of different ways it could go. And I got really excited about exploring that opportunity.
Yeah, it's incredible that it really inspired you to write such a terrific book. I also love the ship's name, the Argus. You know, I did find out that it was the name of a Greek myth guardian with 100 eyes, which seems to make sense if they're, you know, trying to be that last line in the defense for this universe, and that the crew of the ship had such interesting titles: Excubitor, Optio, and Oculi. And I've never seen anything like that in other sci-fi books. Super cool. How did you come up with the titles, you know, for the ranks, the officers, and on the Argus?
My first thought was I didn't want to use real world ranks very badly because I kind of wanted to separate their universe from ours. You know, not necessarily cut it off from potential of having Earth origins, but I wanted it to feel pretty removed. So I wanted to, you know, not use the typical military ranks you might see in a normal military sci-fi. So I kind of just started looking at other options, and I honestly don't really know what inspired me to originally look at sort of the Roman and Greek wording and Latin names for things, but probably I'm a big Codex Alera fan. I don't know if you guys have read that series from Jim Butcher, but there's a lot of Roman legion-esque stuff in that, and it just kind of has always been a favorite of mine. So I might have got it from that, or who knows. But yeah. I just started researching, you know, Roman military structures and the different words. And I didn't use any specific existing actual military structure. I just picked words that I liked that that sounded good. And
that's why, like, you have to figure out what the titles mean. That's kind of the enjoyment of reading the last.
Yeah.
So calling each other these titles, then you after a while you get, oh, okay, he holds rank over Mercer Cavallon, for example. So
right, yeah.
You start to understand it. Yeah.
And yeah, with Oculus, obviously that means eye, and Optio means, I actually forget which that one means, but Dextera, which is the rank for the Titans, which is sort of their elite military group, means right hand. So that kind of thing, you know, I just kind of found ones that may be loosely associated with something that they are doing, and then kind of, I'd sometimes change spellings or change, you know, tenses and things like that, just to, so it'd be whatever sounded good, because I didn't want it to be a whole thing where people had to, like, oh, how do you pronounce this? How do you pronounce this? How do you pronounce this? Yeah. So I tried to find ones where it was like there was kind of inherent pronunciations that you probably wouldn't get super wrong just by guessing.
But it's just such a nice touch to do it. It just made it that much more of a fun read.
Yeah, thank you.
Read some Gene Wolfe, Ron. I'm telling you, same idea.
Sure.
I do think of this as a original book, right? So it's fresh, but it's part of a proud tradition. And I was wondering, I could see on your website that Battlestar Galactica, presumably the new version, but
reboot.
No Lorne Greene in there, but I could see that was an influence. But you also have like a food replicator in there and a warp drive, so there's some Enterprise stuff going on in there. But I'm wondering if you could tell us about some of your other major influences and what got you hooked on writing science fiction?
Yeah, well, definitely Battlestar Galactica. You know, at the time I wrote it, I hadn't watched it in many, many years. So I didn't really think about it directly. Looking back, I'm like, oh, wow, yeah, I definitely used that as an influence. Another big one is the Mass Effect video game series. I'm obsessed with it. It is my favorite piece of media that exists. I love it so much. So that was a really big one as well. And as far as other little things, you know, I actually hadn't, up to that point, read a ton of sci-fi. I mean, I'd read some, but I read primarily fantasy. In my other media is where I consumed most of my sci-fi. So there aren't a lot of books I can call on, whereas like book series is Rendezvous with Rama by Arthur C. Clarke, which is
classic.
My all-time favorite book.
Yeah.
It's the only book I've read more than once. And it definitely, as far as like themes and just overall vibe of the story, that's definitely one I called on. You know, I love the big dumb object trope. Mm-hmm. Big dumb object trope.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense now that you
see. Yeah. So I definitely called on that for, you know, certain things. And yeah, just another show that I love is Killjoys, which is a little more smaller scope, but it definitely has those like really tight friendships that I'm trying to convey between a lot of the characters. So I definitely probably called on that one as well.
You're actually a big reader. We can see from your website that you have stacks of books that you're running through. And I'm just curious what you're reading now.
Yeah, I just finished the first book in the Interdependency by John Scalzi, and I'm forgetting the name. I think it's called Collapsing Empire. I just finished that, and now I'm reading A Tip for the Hangman, which is another 2021 debut about Kit Marlowe, and it's a fictionalization of his life as a spy. And it's just so well written, and the main character reminds me a lot of Cavallon, which has been super entertaining for me. So yeah, I'm trying to kind of read outside of my genre as well. It's hard because you feel like you have to keep up, so you feel like you have every book you read should be a sci-fi book, but then, you know, you're not getting any perspective. So I try to sometimes step out and read some things outside my genre to kind of get a little more perspective on things.
Yeah, I think that's great. So I'm going to ask you a particular question about the technology in The Last Watch, which in particular, I think that the imprints are really fascinating. And I don't, like, where do I get those? How do I get, you know, imprints of my own?
Yeah, we actually love the imprints.
How did you come up with the idea? I mean, they're really fascinating. I don't even know. It's not even clear what the extent of their powers are, but.
Yeah. And you will learn more in future installments. I'll say that.
Great.
But you know, it's hard to tell it. You write it, you're just like, sit down to write it 5 years ago, and then people start asking you questions and you're like, I don't know. There was a picture on Pinterest that I saw. It's actually more of a fantasy concept art picture of a guy just leaning there, and he has sort of more tribal-esque looking tattoos, but they were glowing. And I remember seeing that picture and being like, oh, it'd be super cool to do sort of a sci-fi version of the sort of magic tattoo trope. But, you know, obviously make it nanotechnology so it can be sci-fi. And it was just one of those things where I am a discovery writer, or I was then at least. So I just kind of started writing the first scene, and they just showed up on Cavalon's arm. And I was like, oh, these are great. Cool. What do they look like? And I just kind of built them up as the story went on. And then obviously in revisions went back through and kind of tried to make them a little more consistent in what they could do. But I did try to keep some of it a mystery too, especially when we're in Cavalon's perspective, who doesn't actually know how to use his own.
Yeah, that's pretty clear. He's just not entirely sure what to do with them, right?
Yeah, which is kind of a metaphor for the whole thing in a way, where it's like, you know, Rake has had to earn and figure out how to use hers, whereas Cavalon, it's just a step in the process of him becoming, you know, raising his standing in society. And they're so comfortable in their opulence that they don't need to learn how to use these things that give them strength and speed and things, because they have so much money to just fix that. Whereas, you know, a lot of the other characters are using theirs actually martially in the way that they're intended to be used. So
they're so close to the divide that the crew experiences a ripple. They're dealing with some time issues. And when that happens, they see doppelgangers of other crew members and themselves. We see in the book that the characters can be both amused and disconcerted by what they're seeing. For example, I love this line from Last Watch during Ripple. Adequan looked at the new recruit and narrowed her eyes. Cavalon, she barked. To her surprise, both versions of him snapped to the attention immediately. Sir! She didn't know what was real until the real one on the right flickered. After a few moments, the duplicate disappeared, and a wave of relief washed over the bridge as more and more ripples subsided. And I did think that was interesting because, you know, they're out in deep space. Maybe they've seen these ripples before, but, you know, seeing a doppelganger of yourself is always, you know, gets you out of your space a little bit, right? So,
happens to me, yeah.
I like the idea of having the ripples and the doppelgangers. How did you come with that idea of adding that element into your book?
Yeah, so that's another one that sort of just appeared on the page one day, and I just ran with it. Okay. So when I was writing the second chapter, which is when you first see a time ripple happen, literally just I was in Adequan's POV, and a copy of her walked up the stairs, and I was like, okay, what are we doing here? And then that's kind of how I built on the, you know, I knew I wanted specific things to happen because they were specifically sitting so close to the divide, and also indicative of, as they're, you know, eventually getting a little closer to it, what kinds of things are ramping up and kind of subconsciously warning them that things are about to get worse. So I always had a few things in mind, and I kind of played around with different aspects. And that was one where I was like, is this too weird? Is it going to confuse people? And I worried a lot about it in the early chapters. But once I started getting critique partner and beta reader feedback, it was a fan favorite for sure. Almost everybody seemed to like it. A few people were like, I was confused at first, but once I figured out what was going on, I loved it. So I kept it even though I was a little wary. So I guess that's a good thing as far as, you know, sometimes you just trust your instincts with what you put down on the page and see later if it works.
Yeah. I have to admit that was my same similar feedback. I was a little confused at first that happens, but that's because the character's also confused by it. It's an unpleasant experience for them. So yeah, within very quickly you learn what it means. But I think that I did like the way you presented that. It made me as the reader understand.
Yeah, that's a good
point.
What
the crew going through.
Yeah, that you're also caught off guard by it, right? So you're experiencing the same thing that the crew is experiencing. It's kind of neat to get into their shoes.
Now, much like a Jimmy Webb song, The Last Watch conveys a sense of deep loneliness when it's stationed near the divide. And that's illustrated very well in Adequan Rake and Griffith Bock. You know, I think that's important because I don't see that often in sci-fi books of this nature. Can you tell us more about adding that element in your book?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, it's sort of a quintessential part of what they're going to end up dealing with as they move forward. it's also just showcasing the negligence that they've kind of undergone over the last few years. And I also just, it's somewhat of another one of those sort of symptoms of being near the divide. You know, maybe if they were on a ship in the middle of just deep space somewhere else, they might feel the sense of loneliness and, you know, separation, but it might not be quite as bad because it's being exacerbated by this sort of almost supernatural phenomenon. So I think there's a few different aspects in play there. And it's also another thing that was inspired by a song. I'm very music driven when I write. And there's a song by the Postal Service called This Place is a Prison. And that is actually the inspiration for making it a type of prison at all. I mean, it's not a prison in name, but it's a prison in function. And I was probably listening to that song, feeling lonely and depressed. And it came across on the page.
That's a deep cut, that Postal Service song you're talking about. Most people don't even know the Postal Service. I'm from Seattle and a big
I'm obsessed with fan. Postal Service, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't see Postal Service live, but I saw Death Cab for Cutie in small clubs. Nice. I was working a startup at the time, so
I'm in Vegas.
But that's
awesome.
But that's great to know. That's a Postal Service song.
So I was actually wondering what your favorite character to write was. Like, I immediately you think it's Pavilion because he's the most quirky and rapscallion-y. But you know, is that true? Do you have a favorite character to write, or were there particular scenes between characters that you were kind of really into, or?
Yeah, you're probably right. Cavalon is probably my favorite to write. he's just, whenever I sit down to write a Cavalon chapter, it just falls out of me. It's never a difficult thing to write. I never have to get in a mindset or figure out how I'm going to approach it. He's just very easy in that way. And he's just a lot of fun. You know, specifically in the first book, there are some characters that I maybe enjoyed a little more in the second book, but I kind of always go back to Cavalon as my default. He's just easy to write and it's just fun. I also really enjoyed writing, you know, anything between Rake and her second in command, Jacken. I just really like their dynamic a lot. And I feel like writing two competent people trying to do something impossible is just a lot of fun. And I really enjoyed those two, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because Cavalon sort of combines almost a complete lack of competence with sudden flashes of brilliance, right? You know, he's accumulated all of this academic knowledge that he's able to put to use, but he surprises himself by succeeding. Yeah, I love him. I think he's a great character.
Awesome. Thank you.
So the Argus seems really large. I was wondering, you know, it's a capital ship, right? So I was just wondering if you, did you have any tools that you use to sort of map out the Argus or really anything that's happening? Did you use outlines or maps or any kind of external devices to sort of help you craft the narrative?
Yeah, I am a map person, so there was definitely many versions of maps. So the Argus is actually a dreadnought, so it's a little smaller than a capital ship in that sense. There's another capital ship that crops up sort of later in the book that becomes more of a thing. But with the Argus, I did draw an initial map, just sort of a sketch of where am I putting things and does any of this make sense, especially with the sectors and stuff. And that actually changed. That's one of the things that changed a little bit more than anything else probably in the book, where as I did revisions, I was like, oh, and I need this place to be closer physically to this place. So let's just do a whole restructure. And that's where having those maps kind of comes into play. I usually would just, you know, kind of sketch them out. I did do a whole like fancy illustrator, like cutaway section type of one, which I plan to, you know, put on my website someday maybe or something. But
all right.
Bonus content. Yes. Yeah.
So the world building in Last Watch is really exceptional, right? And I was just wondering about the creative process for the, I know I'm going to mispronounce this no matter what I do, because it's either Viators or Viators. So I'll use both words, the Drudgers. And what was your creative process for developing those beings?
Yeah. So again, Discovery writer. So a lot of that started out, you know, I did some pretty heavy Pinterest boarding at the beginning just to kind of get, I'm a very visual person. So anything I can get to just kind of look at, you know, so I had some vague ideas of kind of that I wanted there to be aliens in general and what that looked like. I maybe didn't specifically know at first, but I'm a big fan, and this was only the second book I had written, so I was still very much figuring out my process at that point. And even now, after writing a couple more, I'm definitely figuring it out. But I've learned that that's one thing that I am kind of carrying through is that I am light on the world building on my first pass. I think it helps me avoid info dumps is the biggest reason. You know, if you don't know anything, you can't dump info about it. So you just kind of let the things that become important to the plot and characters come through naturally. And then when you're done with that draft, you can go back through and think, okay, what's confusing here? What needs fleshed out? What are people going to not have any idea what you're talking about if you don't expand on it a little bit? And then you can kind of build it up a little more rather than, you know, if you have this whole preconceived world in your, which this works for some writers and that's completely fine. But if you have, you know, troves of documents on what the world is, then you're very hemmed in by that information, whether you know it can change or not. You're the boss, obviously, you can do whatever you want. But for how my brain works, I've found that if I don't know the thing, then I can fill it in much easier. But if I feel like it's already a fact, then changing it is kind of difficult for me. So I feel like I end up altering plot and character points where I should be altering world points, if that makes sense.
Hey, Jenny, we really love this book, and I was excited to learn that your next book, the Exiled Fleet, will be available on August 17th. It sounds like a sequel to The Last Watch. Is that the case?
Yep, it is a direct, immediate sequel to
The Last Watch. Great, yeah. Wonderful. Well, we'll be the first to buy it, that's for sure.
Awesome, thank you.
I read in the bio that you're an accomplished cinematographer and screenwriter with several movies credited to you. And I'd like to ask you a little more about how that shaped your experiences for writing your book.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, when I was a child, I did write fiction, you know, quite a bit. But very early on, I would say when I was 8 or 9, I got my first video camera. And from there, it was just all about movies. So really, all of my writing and storytelling from that point on was pretty focused to script writing and shooting movies. I did a lot of film festivals when I was a kid, and then that's what I went to college for. And it just kind of took over my life for many years. And, you know, I think obviously, especially now with how modern stories are told, that translation is pretty easy to, you know, it's the same kind of structure. It's the same kind of character development that you need to deal with. And it's just a matter of you can write kind of more because you're not limited by that sort of 90 page expectation of a script. So I think it, you know, informed my writing just like anyone else's would who maybe got a degree in creative writing or something like that. But I think some of the skills it left me with were definitely dialogue. I love writing dialogue. I will often draft an entire chapter with just dialogue and then go back in and fill in all the other pieces later. So it's made that part easier for me. And just an ability to sort of understand pacing on a more inherent level and not really have to, I, fingers crossed, have yet to have to ever restructure a book that I've written. And I think I can attribute that to that kind of inherent knowledge of how a script is typically paced and structured.
You've already talked about your interest in Mass Effect, right? Which, of course, because it's awesome, that makes perfect sense.
Normandy.
Are there any other games that you sort of, I see that you, I have a sense that you play ESO on occasion too. I'm not a huge Dragon Knight fan, but, you know, but are there, how do games sort of inform your sensibility? Is it similar to screenwriting and cinematography in that respect? Or
I'd say gaming's tough because the story structure is very different, not only because you're picking what you do, especially for the types of games that I enjoy right. the most, which are, you know, the BioWare games, basically, you know, the super character driven stories, but the characters and interactions between them and relationships are something that translates really well. And something that with the type of games that I like to play, especially, translates. And another aspect I would say, which sounds kind of weird, but is like sort of fight choreography, you know, if you've
No, fought, that's not weird, you know, at all. That makes sense. Yeah.
If you've fought a lot of battles in video games and you've seen them, you know, often, you know, even if you play the fight, but then you get this epic cutscene of a battle or a interaction, then you can kind of translate that to your writing pretty easily too. And actually, how I got into fiction writing was I started writing fan fiction for video games, which, yeah.
No shame in that.
No, I love fan fiction. I think it's great. If I had time, I would still be writing it. I just, once you become an author, it's difficult to find the time, you know, with when you also have a day job to also do that. But
Ron is writing Bridgerton fan fiction. Ooh, nice.
All fan fiction is great. But yeah, so I wrote fan fiction, and that kind of gave me the, you know, it was very well received online and people loved it. And I was like, maybe I should like write a book. And then I did. And, you know, yeah.
And there you have it.
There it is. I got one too.
Yours is probably signed.
It is not, but I did start annotating it.
Oh yeah.
I was gonna annotate the whole thing is the theory, and then do like a giveaway or something before the second book comes out. So
cool.
That's a cool idea. Jenny, you did the cinematography and wrote the screenplay for a zombie musical called Rigor Mortis, A Zombie Love Story. I actually saw this on Tubi recently, and I thought it was terrific. And Jake and I are both geeks, and we actually did a whole podcast episode on zombies before. What I thought was interesting was it's the first zombie movie I've seen where you're taking account of the zombies' feelings and perspectives. The two zombies are isolated and lonely. And at the same time, there's a terrific sense of humor in the movie. I love the part where the zombies are dancing using the Thriller moves. I mean, stuff like that is just hilarious. And the other thing, too, is that the humans, at least to me, they come across as the bad guys. I thought that was just a lot of fun watching it. Can you tell us about the writing process and the filming of the movie?
Yeah, definitely. So I co-wrote this with my then boyfriend, now husband, who neither of us actually are big zombie fans, believe it or not. and I don't really know where, I think, you know, we watched Dr. Horribles and we were like, this is amazing. Why does more of this not exist? We need to do this. And we were at a time in our lives where we were freelance. So we would, you know, go through bouts of, you know, being incredibly busy for months and then having nothing to do for months. And during that downtime, we were like, maybe we should write a zombie musical. We'd never written a musical. Neither of us are particularly musically inclined. So we got our composer in on that to help us. Someone we had met who had composed music for some of our films in the past. So we just kind of sat down and we were like, how can we subvert the crap out of this? Like, what are all the ways in which we can make this surprising to people? And then we, at the same time, looked at the zombie tropes and, you know, kind of tried to layer those in so you would get the expectations that you would have from watching a zombie movie while also seeing somewhat of a unique story as far as, you know, how it's portrayed. So it was really fun writing experience. You know, we were pretty much first dating at the time, but, you know, we started living together very quickly, like within 4 months. So it was kind of just
zombies will do that. Yeah. Bring you together.
So yeah, and then we just kind of decided that we were going to do it one day because I don't know, we were bored. So we started the whole process, which was not easy. We found investors, you know, we needed a decent amount of money to do it at the production level we wanted to do it at. So we took our time, we found investors, we got a really good composer, like I said, got really good actors. And then we shot it over, I don't even remember, I want to say 5 days maybe, which is pretty fast.
Yeah, very fast.
But, you know, prior to that, we had shot an entire feature horror film in 11 days. So 5 days seemed like fine for a 30-minute movie.
But yeah, a lot of fun. That's on Tubi right now. It's a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, thanks. I think it's still on iTunes as well. It's a bunch of places. We have a distributor that we don't really talk to anymore, but it's places. It's consumable. Yeah.
Would you consider doing another musical?
Probably not, to be honest. I mean, we would never put it out of the realm of possibility, but it was relatively, I don't want to say traumatic, but it was at a time in our lives where we were pretty poor, and we were just kind of starting out in our careers, and we graduated at 2008, which was a terrible time to graduate and go into the freelance business. So we did do a fair amount of, you know, indie films and things like that, but we just got really, really burnt out. My husband got pneumonia before we even started shooting. So he basically shot the whole thing with pneumonia. I was very, very sick, bronchitis, not pneumonia, thank God, but it was just, and then after that, you know, it was just kind of like so much effort. And it just really, really burnt us out. And that's kind of around when my husband got more of a full-time job. We're still both in film-related in the industry, but, you know, more stable jobs and things like that, where we could kind of know where our money was going to come from and when it was going to come. And so we kind of associate the filming with it, unfortunately, even though we're very proud of the final product and we love that we did it and we wouldn't change that we did it. Looking back at it is kind of, we're like, okay, we're maybe past that point in our lives.
Deeply traumatized.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Is your next book science fiction, or is it going to be a different genre, or if, like, what's
Yeah, well, the sequel obviously is.
I mean, after the sequel.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm jumping ahead too much.
I plan to stick in the science fiction realm for probably quite a while, just even from a career standpoint, you kind of want to stay in one lane for a little bit, at least until you're established. I would happily jump into the fantasy realm as well. I don't honestly right now have many ideas in the fantasy genre, but most of my future ideas are science fiction. And so, yeah, you'll probably see me there for quite a while.
Well, listeners, we're going to have a last watch book giveaway contest. One book is courtesy of Tor Books, and the other we're going to purchase from Jenny's favorite indie bookstore in Madison, Wisconsin, a room of one's own. Listeners, we're going to provide the details for the contest a little later in the episode. You know, Jenny, we want to thank you again for joining the podcast today. We love The Last Watch, and luckily for everyone, it'll be available on April 20th. You'll find where to get a copy of Jenny's book on our website at jsduis.com, and we'll include that link in our show notes. Thanks so much for being here today, Jenny.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Well, that was great, Jake, having J.S. Duis on the show to talk about her book. Yeah, and I thought it was really great to hear about the creative process, you know, their influences for the book as well. Real treat to have her on the show. Was there anything that you learned from the interview that made the book a little more interesting for you?
I was more intrigued by her kind of her creative process and how she kind of puts things together. She calls herself a discovery author,
which is
a term I hadn't really heard before. So, it's sort of clear that some more traditional, I guess, approaches to narrative construction, she kind of shuffles aside in favor of kind of really more just letting the creative juices flow and kind of writing as it comes, which I think is neat.
Yeah, that was pretty cool because I remember being back in college and we were studying beat writers like Kerouac and the poet Allen Ginsberg, and the whole idea was like taking your ideas and getting them out there as quickly as you can. And it sounds like she writes much better when she's just she's in front of the screen and just letting her imagination
run away. And
so
I'd like to see her maps. Some of her maps and illustrations like that. I'm kind of intrigued by that. But I'm also looking forward to the next book, find out what happens. And I really like that Cavalon has quickly become one of my favorite.
Yeah, it's been
science fiction protagonist. So,
and I just like how she gets inspiration from things like the Jimmy Webb song, and even another Jimmy Webb song was influenced. Characters.
I felt sure you were going to sing that.
No. Like that. I thought I'd spare the listening audience this time.
I told you I had a an earworm for a while with MacArthur Park.
Oh yes, yes.
Yeah, the entire suite actually. I couldn't get out of my head for like a solid month.
Yeah.
So well, I too am a Webb fan, but
yeah. I won't sing that one. I kind of had an earworm for Up, Up and Away in my beautiful balloon.
Oh, that's a classic in its own right. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So listeners, as we were talking about to Jenny, we're going to have a giveaway contest for The Last Watch. One book is courtesy of Tor Books, and the other we're purchasing from Jenny's favorite indie bookstore in Madison, Wisconsin, A Room of One's Own. For the listeners, the contest works this way. Please subscribe to the podcast and take a screenshot on that on your cell phone or computer, however you listen to the podcast. And then send us a number between 1 and 200 and email it to thewrathoftheiocians@gmail.com. We'll run this contest through the end of May, and we'll announce the winner sometime in early June. So again, please take a screenshot of yourself with showing that you've made a subscription and subscribe to our podcast. Include a number between 1 and 200. We'll have a random number generator application that will choose the two numbers that we that will determine the winner. yeah, we're really
excited. Choose 39. Any number but 39.
So yeah, we're excited to give away the book, and yeah, listeners really think it's going to be a favorite for readers, and we also think it's going to be a pretty good Netflix and Hulu show if they ever decide to go in that direction. So terrific read, and we're very happy again to hear that the sequel, The Exiled Fleet, will be coming out shortly afterwards. Great. Well, hey, Jake, I really had a lot of fun talking to Jenny today. I hope to have her again on the show another time, but that was a lot
next
of fun.
Book.
Hopefully we can talk to her about The Exiled Fleet. So that was
another really interesting author.
Yes.
All right, we've been getting lucky.
Yeah, we're very, very lucky. Great interview. We'll see you in the next episode.
All right. See you soon.
Thanks, everyone.